10. An invisible tipping point. Jun. In a hotel room in Prince Rupert, British Columbia, looking out on a Tim Hortons donut and coffee shop, Marius set up a world in a box for Jun's phone to inhabit while they investigated what Augur was and worked out what to do next. A fake mobile network for it to connect to, scanning for information about enemies and disasters. On one of Marius's homebrew arrangements of chips and screens, they watched Augur try to crawl the web, to look for threats and protect Jun. The fake mobile network gave it nothing of interest. It worked tirelessly inside its little box, thinking it was contacting the world, like an insect in a tiny, perfect environment in a terrarium. Marius and Jun had looked through Augur's assets. There was a video labeled simply, watchme.mp4.
Look at this, said Marius. Maybe they make movie of themselves doing evil.
But he'd been surprised when it turned out they had. There was a man called C. Packship pitching a product called Augur. Jun recognized the inside of the mountain, not to mention everyone's clothing, at once. Marius hated everything Packship said and muttered, "Sick fucks," several times during the video. At the end, the microphone picked up a brief conversation between Lank Skatlish and Martha.
"If it works, I'm in," muttered Lank.
"I think he's got it," said Martha. "What he's done is very impressive."
There was a camaraderie and ease between them that made Jun bitingly jealous.
"You've tested it?"
"I've had some people walking around with it for months. Nothing they can see on their phones. I monitor the data remotely, it's good. Not quite as good as he says. He can't do 14 days, but 24 to 48 hours? Yes."
"That's enough. Okay, but if we're taking it, we need to make sure we delete all the test builds, okay? Anyone who's had it, all of them. Get someone on that. I'm not risking it. They need to be gone."
Marius looked at Jun.
"Fucking Bogdan," he said at last. "If you connect to real internet, they know where you are. They delete again."
"Or they come and burn the building down." Marius shook his head.
"Fire is last resort. Bogdan is idiot, but he turned phone off and on quickly. Leave it on for 5 minutes and they remote delete. Safe and clean."
Jun said, "Was I just a tester? Do you think it works? I mean, really actually works?" Marius thought about this.
"It is good at one thing. Generate survival plan quickly. That we know it can do."
"That's not an answer. That's what you talk about, iteration. We tell it the parameters, it iterates a million times a second. We tell it what success is and when it's failed. I can imagine how it could get good at that in a lot of simulations. What about the future prediction stuff?"
"If it works, we know something new about world, about consciousness, about time."
"That's it?"
"I don't know if Augur can know future. I know I don't know future. I don't know everything. I couldn't do it. But maybe they found answer. Maybe it works."
In the box, the fierce little insect tried to save her life over and over again. They had been in Prince Rupert, British Columbia, for 4 days now. Marius had burns on his shoulders where they'd peeked out of the water. Jun had dressed them every day with fresh bandages from Safeway. He refused painkillers and downed half a bottle of scotch every day. They had tried, repeatedly, using all of Marius's skill, to record the screen of the phone, to voice record the audio of C. Packship's speech. It had all been digitally treated. What they ended up with was noise, black screens. Maybe if they had an ancient tape recorder or a 1980s video camera, they could do something. But then that stuff could be faked so easily. They had tried to figure out what to do now, where to take this. To the press, maybe? A trip in person to New York, show it to someone. They would seem like lunatics, but if the plans were this advanced, if the apocalypse was this near, Jun thought of the boxes they'd seen in Zimri Gnomic's bunker. Would revealing all of this just
push something over an invisible tipping point? Marius stretched. His bandages crackled.
Fuck, he said. Fuck. I need sugar. Sugar, coffee, donuts. Tim Hortons.
He pointed a thick finger toward the window. In the heated, vanilla-scented air of a Tim Hortons between the Gulf of Alaska and the North Pacific, Marius stirred his coffee with a disposable plastic baton. Jin chose a donut hole decorated with rainbow unicorn sprinkles. She tried to tempt herself to eat it, but all she could see was the collection of scientific food processes that had gone into making it. The colors stirred in great vats, the sprinkle extrusion machines, the metal plates with the unicorn images that the sugar could be pressed into. All so that she could imagine, what, putting a band of color from the sky into her mouth? Becoming one with the reality of impossible animals? Shut up, Jun. Shut up, brain. Eat the fucking donut. Behind the counter, the server, whose name tag said, "Hi, my name is Marie," made a strangled sound, between a squeak of pleasure and a choke. She was staring at the wall-mounted television. There was a photograph of Zimri Nomik, smiling on the screen. For a terrified moment, Jun thought he had found them somehow, and his image was about to become real. Then the image flicked into a photograph of Ellen Bywater and Lenk Skettlish together at a summer party. And while Marie scrabbled for the remote and clattered it on the floor and grabbed it and turned the volume up, the Chiron scrolled across the bottom of the screen. Lenk Skettlish, Ellen Bywater, and Zimri Nomik, CEOs of Fantail, Medlar, and Anvil, missing in suspected plane crash. The volume turned on, but the crashing sound continued to echo in Shun's ears. At first, it had been difficult to tell whether the plane was missing or not, said the television news reporter, because the three billionaires had left secretly. They had been attending the Action Now Sustainability Conference together and had taken part in a joint panel on corporate responsibility. There were indications that they'd left together late on Friday to enter confidential closed-session negotiations, perhaps about environmental mitigation. Out of the corner of her eye, Shun could almost see C. Packship leaning in, saying, "Augur will work with you to create a plausible story." Their jet, Flight GNZAB, had taken off from a private airfield in Northern California. They had filed a flight plan indicating that they were heading west and then north. The plane had flown out into the North Pacific Ocean, past the point where it was monitored by radar from land. After that point, the plane had given its position verbally until 7 a.m., when it should have been picked up by radar in Alaska. The plane had gone silent. There was no sign of it in Alaska. There was no sign of it anywhere. As the newsreader tried to compose himself, there was a moment of complete silence. The imaginary CPAC ship moved close to her ear and said, "You'll have time for dinner before you head for the plane." Shun had once seen an interview in a television documentary about Ayn Rand. Her most famous book was a fantasy that if a few wealthy and powerful people disappeared, the world would end. In the interview, Rand was talking about death, about what dying meant to her. She said, "I will not die. It's the world that will end." The works of Ayn Rand were extremely popular in Silicon Valley. This was what Lenk Skettlish and Ellen Bywater and Zimri Nomik believed. This was what they had paid for. They would not die. It was the world that would end. It was not Skettlish, Bywater, and Nomik who were missing. It was the future. Marius said,
"Sick fucks. They did it.
Something's falling apart. Whatever it is, it's coming quickly," said Shun.
"Okay, let's go," said Marius. "Go! We need to turn it on."
In the hotel room, the news continued to scroll. There was grief and bewilderment on the television and the feeds, a sense still that the thing was impossible, the details of the search for parts of a plane, the possibility that a lifeboat or a crash jacket might still be found sustaining the world's great technology leaders.
an expert on the history of aviation disasters was called in to run the viewers through a list of missing planes and the eventual outcome of each mystery. Someone said, "Hopes are dwindling." On another channel, someone said, "When should we give up hope?" There was a rushing sound in Shun's ears. Shun took her phone from the box and, holding it in both hands, turned it on, unlocked the screen, connected to the internet. There were her old apps, like a memory of a person she used to be, the things she used to look at every day. She felt a kind of grief looking at the screen. She wanted to walk back through it into the world as it used to be. Dozens of texts pinged up. Friends and family, discount offers, spam and phishing. Nothing. And then everything. The screen went black. There was a message in green letters. It said, "Lai Jun, this is Augur. An extraction is being arranged. Stay where you are." On the old phone, Jun sent Martha a text message. "Is this real? I've had an Augur activation." It wasn't delivered. Whatever had happened, Martha had gone too. In desperation, Shun looked up Martha's profile on Fantail. They'd sent each other a few messages that way before, but Martha had been hesitant to send anything via her own platform. Maybe she was worried Lank Sketlish would see it. Still, worth a try. Shun sent the same message. 5 minutes. 6 minutes. Then, three dots, typing. Then the dots went away. 7 minutes, 8 minutes, 10 minutes. Three dots. "It's real," said Martha. "I didn't know it'd ping you."
"What do you mean it's real?"
"We've got to get out," said Martha. "My friends and I thought we could do something before this happened, fix it. But we were too late. It's coming now." A cold line of fear in Jun's throat.
"What's coming?"
"Just do what Augur tells you, okay? I can tell you when I see you. I'm going to delete these now."
As Chun watched, her messages and Martha's unraveled themselves from the screen, erasing upward, until all that was left was a hopeful smiley face Martha had sent her several months earlier. For 5 hours, the news rolled on, CNN and BBC, Fox and Fantail Net all sending hopes and prayers, expectations and suppositions. The armies of three countries were scouring the ocean. There would be a black box sending out its hopeful bips. There might not have been a tragedy. And yet, said the news, the sea off the Bering Strait was this temperature. Without survival equipment, the human body would only continue to function at that temperature for 2 hours. For 1 hour, for 36 minutes. The knowledge spooled out across the world, and some were angry and some were sad and many were jubilant. Sick fuckers. World doesn't need any more billionaires shooting penis-shaped rockets into space. And many were angry at the jubilation and told stories of how they'd never have found their army buddy or their high school sweetheart again without Fantail. They'd done the best work of their life on a Medlar thin screen. They'd relied on deliveries from Anvil when they had the 2020 novel coronavirus. A million boring opinions screamed with angry urgency. The stock in all three companies plummeted. Then stock markets all over the world plummeted. 10%, 20%, 30%, 40%. "A great day to buy cheap," said a commenter, and then had to resign 2 hours later. And none of them knew what this meant. They still thought there was a future to imagine.
"What do we do if transport comes for me?" said Shun.
Marius looked at her.
"You want to live through the end of the world?"
"I don't want to leave you here in a hotel in Prince Rupert while I go off with my golden ticket."
"Why better for me if I know you suffering too?"
"Whatever it is, I'll try to find a way to bring you."
Marius shook his head.
"I go back to Bucharest, to Sarit, to stupid fuck Bogdan and my stupid fuck students."
At 4 a.m, Shun had slept a little and woke to the sound of a soft, insistent ping from her phone. She shook Marius awake from his snoring sleep, and they looked together. Augur said, "Your transport is downstairs, Lai Zhen." There was a long black car parked outside on the street, peacefully waiting for the end of the world. The extraction, the perimeter, whatever was going to happen hadn't yet disturbed the possibility of seamless efficiency. What is the point of anything at all if you're not going to survive? If you live, you might be able to do something. If you die, you won't do anything. The story of Lot and his daughters isn't a story of human thriving, but it's better than what happened to the people in Sodom. Downstairs, the car was a BMW, and the seats were warmed leather. The door was open, and a plump man with an American accent was in the driver's seat behind a smoked glass screen. He had an airborne, plague-safe N99 mask strapped across the lower part of his face.
"Lai Zhen," he said.
"Yeah," she said. "Where are we going?"
"I'm following the navigation."
He pointed to the screen. It was still before dawn, and it had rained in the night. The streets were shiny and still. They moved swiftly through the city, north and east, out, open country. An hour outside the city on a quiet road, the car stopped. The screen descended.
"The protocol is that we wait here," said the driver.
They were in the car for around 45 minutes, waiting. They talked some. They were silent some. Shun thought about what it was she'd wanted out of her whole entire life, and, if that was all over now, what she could possibly do that was worth a damn. At last, Shun heard the distant sound of a helicopter at the same moment that the driver grabbed her wrist, and she felt a sharp scratch on the back of her hand.
"Don't worry," he said. "You're going somewhere with a million beautiful things."